Human rights activists say the death toll after 9 weeks of protest has topped 1,000, making it one of the deadliest uprisings of this Arab Spring. And it could have a huge ripple effect in the region. For instance, neighboring Lebanon is watching nervously. Soldiers in Beirut acted as a buffer yesterday between protesters for and against Syrian President Bashar Assad. Syrians inside and outside their country have been using social media, blogging and tweeting and posting videos like this one from a demonstration in which protesters chant, "We take death but never humiliation," and the Syrian people are united. But there are concerns that the Syrian government is cracking down on and co-opting the social media. And there are questions about just who is leading the opposition. Well, joining us in the studio, one of the key young players, Usama Monajed, is a London-based activist, one of the founders of a new coalition of activists inside and outside Syria, the National Initiative for Change. He's hoping to gather the various Syrian opposition groups together at a conference in Turkey. He's actually in his car. Usama, welcome.
Thank you.
And let's talk a little bit about social media first, because do I understand you have your laptop going all the time?
Yes, absolutely. My iPhone, my iPad, all the time.
Well, communicating with people inside and outside Syria. So first of all, Tom Friedman wrote in the New York Times this weekend that while Syrian police at first didn't even know what a Facebook was, they were asking people at checkpoints, "Do you have a Facebook?" meaning literally a book. Now, they're much more informed. They're demanding people's passwords. Syrian officials have created the Syrian Electronic Army to fight dissidents online. Your thoughts?
Well, yeah, they knew about Facebook and lower ranks, yes, certainly. Perhaps they were, you know, stupid enough to ask for these questions. But higher up, they already know Facebook and they monitor activists. And this goes years before the uprising. Mm. And that's why when they lifted the ban on Facebook and YouTube
last February
in Syria, yes, we advised activists not to access Facebook and YouTube through the Syrian server.
But still, we're reading that what the Syrian government is doing, unlike Egypt, which tried to shut down all social media, they're being selective. They're cutting down electricity in neighborhoods where there is unrest, but then hacking into websites elsewhere, people turning on and seeing pro-government messages on their Facebook pages. We understand how much Facebook has increased since the ban was lifted in February. But if this crackdown continues, does that cut down and perhaps stop the revolution?
Well, certainly not. The revolution is not remotely controlled by Facebook or YouTube or Twitter. It is supported and facilitated by these means, but it hasn't started by Facebook merely. People are now creating false accounts or accounts under different identities. And also, if someone was arrested, you'd see another activist logging straight away to his friend's account and clearing certain comments or certain friends from his network. People adapt quickly, very quickly, and this is the interesting part, is they are far more quicker in their adaptation than the security forces and the intelligence agencies in Syria.
Well, put aside the question of social media, why do you think this has stalled? New York Times columnist Tom Friedman sketched out the stakes for the region. If the government in Syria falls and it becomes democratic, but along the way maybe goes through some chaos, he writes, "This is a fight to the death now. It's the biggest show on earth because it has huge ramifications for Lebanon, a country Syria has controlled since the mid-1970s, for Israel, which has counted on Syria to keep the peace on the Golan Heights since 1967, for Iran, since Syria is Iran's main platform for exporting revolution into the Arab world. For the Lebanese, the Shiite militia Hezbollah gets rockets from Iran via Syria. For Turkey, which abuts Syria, for Iraq, which suffered from Syria serving as a conduit for jihadist suicide bombers, for Hamas, whose leader sits in Damascus in Syria. I mean, it just has these tentacles in every country. Do you worry that actors in the region, you know, some may benefit, but those that won't, do you think they think it's just too risky to back your revolution?
Does this argument mean that people still have to be living under oppression? Does it mean people should be killed and activists should die? The revolution is moving forward, I mean, regardless of whoever is going to support, whoever is not. And it's mainly a myth that is the regime is promoting. There'll be chaos, there'll be disasters, there'll be war. Even, you know, when Mubarak fell, people expected there will be a war with Israel, and I mean, all discovered that this is part of the regime propaganda.
Well, a bigger question might be, can you and others bring together the sects in Syria? You're a Sunni, which is the majority right now, but minorities like Alawites, one was quoted in the New York Times saying he's conflicted. He wants freedom, but he also wants stability. He believes his Sunni friends want revolution. So what's the internal debate?
Well, of course. I mean, minorities in any country are always the last to join, are always afraid of changes in any society they live in. But it is certainly not all Alawites are benefiting from the system. And this is what frustrates our Alawite friends and our Christian friends, is that they are being looked at as if they are supporters. In fact, they are not supporters of this regime. They're only afraid of what's going to happen afterwards.
Well, and as you know, it's very difficult for Western journalists to confirm what you and others, many others, are saying is happening inside your country because they can't get in. Martin Fletcher is the only Western journalist who's been in lately. He's with the London Telegraph now, and he said you have to take what activists say with a grain of salt. You reported that one of your contacts said that the government is poisoning the water system to keep protests down. You know, how do you respond to those questions about we just don't know what you're passing on to us?
Well, you don't have to trust all the stories, but you have to trust your eyes. When you see people are being fired upon and shot at and killed and sniped, you cannot just lie to your eyes. When you see women crying and you see thousands marching and you see funerals in every place and you see hundreds of videos coming every Friday, you have to trust your eyes.
But to what end, I guess, is the question. Would you want a U.S.-led invasion? What do you want people to do?
Well, certainly we're not after a military intervention, and there is no appetite for that in the first place.
Yeah.
And we're not asking for it. We're asking the international community to put pressure on Russia and China to impose sanctions on Syria vis-a-vis Iran at a UN level. We are asking them to build a consensus in the region to start seeing viable scenarios of change in Syria.
Is one of them that President Assad stays? Is that possible at this point?
The problem now with Assad, that he made it very difficult. If he said that he's not ordering the shooting and killing, then he has no authority. And if he ordered the killing, then he's a killer, and he has to put on the trial and also go.
Hmm.
So they are shooting themselves in the foot, really.
As they shoot Syrians. Osama Manajed, a London-based activist, one of the founders of a new coalition of activists inside and outside Syria, the National Initiative for Change. Osama, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We're talking about the uprising in Syria, which is at something of a stalemate. In the last 2 months, forces loyal to President Bashar Assad have fired on protesters. As many as 1,000 have been killed. Last week, President Obama called on Assad, previously thought to be a potential moderating force in the region, to either change or get out of the way. And we just heard from an opposition leader. Now let's bring in Professor Josh Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He joins us from NPR member station KGOU in Norman. And Josh, we just asked activist Osama Manajed the question many people have. So let's address that first, get it out of the way. Journalists are barred from Syria. You know Osama. Should we trust what he says about government attacks on the opposition?
Well, Osama is very brave, and he's worked extremely hard with a bunch of other activists to try to give some direction, try to get this revolution going in a liberal direction, and to work with all this video that's coming, streaming out of the country from phones and so forth, and to edit it, explain what it is, put it out in front of the journalists, and to push the revolution. And this is a much bigger movement. We don't really know. Osama promises us that in Turkey, there's the different wings are going to come together and hammer out some larger platform. And that, I think everybody will be eager to see how it happens. Syria in the past has been an extremely divided country. And this is, you know, the anxiety, I think, for many Assyrians is, who is this revolution being led by? What do they want? Who's going to take over? Are we going to have stability? Or is there going to be an Iraq-type scenario for Syria?
Well, and do we have an answer to that? You know, in Egypt is still sorting out its post-revolution, one that went much quicker, and still it's, you know, sorting things out. So do we have an answer to what's going on in Syria?
Well, Osama gave a very glowing picture of what could happen. But the concern of civil war is very much alive, and it's not just a regime propaganda tool. Syria is very different from Egypt and Tunisia. Egypt and Tunisia, everybody is Sunni and a Muslim. Syria is a land of minorities. You know, some Ottoman official in the 18th century called it Noah's Ark because there were two of everything. And this is the problem we've seen in Lebanon and Iraq, where identity, unfortunately, the nation and national identity has not quite consolidated. Now, Osama rightly points out that this is something that Syrians have to face. They cannot be held hostage by their fear of themselves forever. And the regime has played on this fear expertly for 40 years. It's hard to say what's going to come out of this. And you've asked about whether, you know, what we're seeing on TV is the truth. Well, largely it is the truth. There is a brutal, repressive movement going on now. But the fact of the matter is we don't know what the Syrian opposition is. Syrians have no clue because there's been a lid on this country for 40 years, just as there was in Iraq. So we don't know what is really animating society. And I don't think many of the opposition have a clue either, because there's no way to know.
But still, you have President Obama in his speech last week saying that President Assad has to step aside or has to change. And yet, then, we also read that there's some hesitancy to back change in Syria because, as we said in Tom Friedman's beautiful paragraph there, so much of what happens in the region depends on Syria, including, you know, this tenuous border with Israel. So what is the U.S. wish? Can you read that tea leaf?
You know, I've been arguing with my friends, some of whom say President Obama, by saying that Assad has to do these various things or get out of the way, that means he really is counting on him to do these various things, and it gives him a lifeline. Others are saying no. The Washington administration has clearly crossed the bridge and is willing to look at Syria in a post-Assad world. Now, I think the administration is very conflicted because the opposition is very young. They're led by young activists who we don't know yet. And there isn't a central leadership. They can't form a central leadership. So they need to solve that problem of division. They need to establish some political parties that will stand up and say what they stand for in a future Syria rather than just, say we want to bring down the regime.
And quick question on whether or not while the members of the opposition are meeting to try to communicate what they stand for, the Syrian government is working to cut their lifelines of communication. One observer says, if you win quickly in an uprising, social media is the right tool to use. If you don't win quickly, which is what's happening in Syria, it becomes more dangerous. Your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. As we saw in Egypt and Tunisia, where there was a quick win and the regimes were caught flat-footed and they didn't know what to do, they tried to shut down the entire, you know, telephone network, and things went badly for them because their militaries ultimately turned away from them. In Syria, it's very different. You know, Bashar al-Assad, in many ways, is a victim of his own reforms because his father kept Syria in a tight box. It was a socialist country. It had almost no access to the outside world. There were three newspapers. There was no internet, nothing. Bashar came along and said, I'm going to globalize. He was a young guy. He wanted to offer Syrians a chicken in every pot, and he did. He opened up the internet, Facebook, all this stuff, and Syrians have had an incredible education. They become globalized. And social media made the regime look extremely weak and incompetent and small in the face of this monstrous network of people who found each other, became conscious of their own powers, and were able to use Facebook and so forth and Twitter and all of the modern and get this video out. The video phone has been the transformative thing. 2 months ago, the Syrian youth was depoliticized, materialistic, and had no clue about politics. Today, it's passionate, it's politicized, many of them are revolutionary. 46% of Syrians are 19 years old or younger. Half of Syrians are in high school or freshmen in college. They are coming alive today around this movement, which they'd never done before. And they have very few prospects. They don't have jobs. They're poor. 32% of Syrians live on $2 a day or less. This is a powerful force. And, people like Osama, who are extremely well-educated and have been brought up in the West and can lead this revolution, have an extraordinarily important task to do, which is to educate and to control the passions of these people, which will be hard to do.
As we're seeing in Egypt. Professor Josh Landis, Director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.